across the galaxy. This is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello and welcome to the Free Zone. Well, as you guys have probably noticed, there is a new FreemanTV.com. I'm so excited about this. It's obviously way more mobile friendly, and of course it's just going to get better from here. So it's not done. We're still working at it, but there it is for you guys to go check it out. So get over to freemantv.com and check out the new digs. It's amazing. My good friends, Alonzo Picardo, I hope I got that right, and David Boozer have been behind the scenes setting this all up, helping me get this going, because we want you to be able to share this information. We want you to feel sophisticated and as if you are getting the full story here without any hype, fear, or any misguidings going on. So that's what the new FreemanTV.com is all about, and I'm so excited about it. I can't wait to just keep digging in and getting it all going. So you will see a new format to the show coming this way. We're going to be coming at you live, 9 p.m. Monday nights. That's 9 p.m. Eastern, folks. I'm over here in South Carolina. So 9 p.m. Eastern, we will be having live broadcasts with our guests for you to come and join in. You can chat. You can phone in, ask questions. It's going to be amazing. And then the members, you guys are going to get the deep stuff. We're going to get deep into research and lay everything out for you. So guys, get out there, subscribe today, because it's just getting bigger and better in here. And we have so much planned for you. And the more of you that join in, the bigger and better it all gets. So thank you all so much. Tonight, now, let me tell you, there has been one thing that's been going through this storyline from day one that has not escaped. It comes from one simple sentence in the Bible, and yet has guided the research of so many authors and philosophers and mystics, that it is a topic that cannot be skipped. From Brad Pitt to George Bush, Madonna to Hillary, we know that the elite of planet Earth all share a single bloodline. We cannot deny this. They throw it in our face. They are proud of this fact. And if we take this bloodline, we begin to know who the nefarious authors of our reality are. Now, the simple phrase in the Bible, of course, is from Genesis 6. And tonight we are going to talk with Gary Wayne, and he is author of The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humanity. You can check out his work, get his books at Genesis6Conspiracy.com. And we're going to get deep into this bloodline, folks, and we're going to find out just who these nefarious beings are and how this relates all the way back to the flood. So welcome to the show, Gary.
Well, thank you, and very, very happy to be here tonight. I think we're going to talk about a very interesting subject, and I think it has the ability to go in about 1,000 different directions, so it'll be interesting to see where the conversation goes tonight.
Absolutely, and without a doubt, this is the biggest story out there. No matter how you turn it, if you're talking about vampires, aliens, or ancient aliens and gods, the Genesis 6 story, it just can't be ignored. I mean, we have this simple sentence. When man began to increase in number on earth, the daughters were born to them. The sons of God saw that they were beautiful, and they married of them any they chose. Now, that seems so simple until you start to ask the questions. Well, what do they mean by these sons of gods? And why is this even important?
And the questions just keep coming after you ask those questions. And
that's true.
And I think, you know, it's really, you know, a lot of people just don't want to deal with Genesis 6, and certainly isn't a topic that's taught in mainstream theology or in your day-to-day church sessions on Sundays or Saturdays, depending on which denomination that you belong to. And it's been kind of shelved to the sidelines, because I think a lot of Christianity, certainly mainstream churches, almost look at it as a bit of an embarrassment that anything that might be supernatural is just not something that they want to talk about, or at least in this sort of manner of supernatural, and which is really kind of odd because the Bible is just filled with supernatural stories.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. I'm thinking of the angels that visit the doorway that everybody wants to have sex with. Now, how would you handle this when you're looking at an angelic conspiracy? Because really, when we're talking about the sons of God, when you really dig down to it, you're up to fallen angels, and you're to the concepts of fallen angels. And when you read the Bible and you take it literal and you have angels showing up at the door, then that are men, that are human, that could have sex with people, you know, that's what they're thinking about when they're in Sodom and Gomorrah, right?
Mm-hmm. And again, not many people relate fallen angels to Sodom and Gomorrah. Although there are angels that are sent from God to go with Abraham, who meet up with Abraham and then go and meet up with Lot in Sodom. But what's really quite interesting is when you get beyond the Christian biblical scriptures of Sodom and giants, if you get into the Gnostic scriptures, and they relate Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain as completely different light than what the Christian perspective is, which was all evil and sexual perversion and not really a mention of Nephilim, but the Gnostics have a completely different perception that those were cities of learning, those were cities of light, those were cities of sexual freedom, and they were destroyed by God as an evil act of the God of the Bible. So depending on which perspective you're looking at Sodom and Gomorrah at, and whether or not you want to relate Nephilim to Sodom and Gomorrah or not, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that the Nephilim were part of the secret societies and the religions that restarted in Sodom and Gomorrah. And biblically, if you go to couple verses in the New Testament, one of them relates a verse where it talks about the sins of the time of Noah and connects it with Sodom and Gomorrah. And so in that, there's a Greek word that was originally used in there that is octotarian, and that's sort of an inhabitant. And in when we look at another verse, and that was Jude 1:5-6 I'm talking about, where the angels left their place in heaven and their habitation, and this Greek original word octarian comes up. And that is really defined in 2 Corinthians 5:2, where it talks about the dwelling of earth. And it's only used twice, this Greek word is in 2 Corinthians and in Jude, where somehow the angels are able to take off their clothing of heaven, and they change somehow. And this is where the changeling sort of concept sort of comes in, that they were able to choose a gender and were affected somehow by the physical realm once they took off this octotarian clothing from heaven. And so they could choose their gender, and they could have sex, and they could somehow create these super beings that are talked about in Genesis 6 and then throughout the Old Testament.
Well, let's go ahead and roll it back then. Let's talk about this Genesis 6 conspiracy, because we have just two simple paragraphs in the Bible to outline this. But then we have the extra-biblical apocryphal works such as the book of Enoch. So let's talk about the fall of these angels, the rebellion, and how this relates in the book of Enoch in comparison with what we get in the Bible.
Okay. And so there are several different books of Enoch, one being the book of Jubilees, one being the book of Giants, the first book of Enoch, the second book of Enoch, and so on. I think the first thing we need to sort of put on the table is that there were two Enochs, and most people don't realize this. So there's the holy Enoch that was the descendant of Seth, Seth and this Enoch were of the lineage of Noah, for the people who may not know the Genesis 6 bloodlines. And then there's the bloodline of Cain, and first son of Cain is Enoch. Now, both wrote scriptures. So not all the Enoch scriptures are going to line up in consistency with biblical scripture. So depending on whether or not you have a polytheist or a Gnostic belief or other names for the same type of religion, you're going to have a whole different look at as to which book of Enoch is legitimate or not. For a Christian, and I am a Christian, though I'd like to make my bias clear on this, is that although I will use those other scriptures that are not aligned with scripture, and I'll use that for context, I'll weigh everything against what the Bible says. So I'll take certain books like the Book of Jubilees and say, that one is just strays so far from scripture, I'll take it as context, but I won't use it as a basis for my conclusion. And so when we look at the various books of Enoch, they are filled with prehistory and the what they call the Watchers, which was a particular form of angel. And this particular order, as in Greek, that probably many of your readers will be familiar with, was translated to Greek as Grigori or as Grigori. And this was a particular rank of seraphim angel that were led to Mount Hermon, according to the books of Enoch, and there were 200 of them in the Enochian version, as opposed to 300 that were in the Sumerian versions. And they were led there by Lucifer to cohabitate with the daughters of men, and created giants because of that. And so if somebody is looking for significant context around what was going on in Genesis, I highly recommend that they read the various books of Enoch, but also keep in mind what I just said, that there were two Enochs.
All right. Yeah, I'll tell you one thing that really kind of freaked me out about reading the Book of Enoch, the only one I knew of, was this idea that you did not go straight to heaven. There were these cylinders that would hold souls until the judgment. And that just kind of, I don't know, it creeped me out a little bit to think that I'd be held in this cylinder until judgment day.
Yeah, and again, those are certain sort of variations that come out of Enoch, and that's why they're considered also apocrypha. But we also need to know that many of the church fathers quoted Enoch, much of the Bible quotes certain books of Enoch, and so there are, obviously there was Enochian scripture. Whether or not the ones that are surviving are the same ones or not, we don't know that, but we do have several books of Enoch, and they do have some things that sort of veer off. And certainly biblically, for the most part, you're going to, when people die, they go to sleep. And that's, I don't know how many times it's listed in the Bible, but you sleep until the time of the resurrection and the judgment from a Christian perspective. So you can see that that sort of view is a bit different than a Christian monotheist view, and that comes more from, I think, the influence of the other religions. What's really interesting about Enoch of the Cain side, and I'll talk about this in my book, and let me just sort of tie this in so people may not quite understand where I'm coming from completely on this. So we have quite a conspiracy going on in prehistory, and you alluded to the rebellion of fallen angels, which is inexplicably and intricately tied to what's going on in Genesis, but I'd sooner back into that from putting this on the table first. So before the rise of the giants, there's another several partners going on. So we have these dark angels, these fallen angels, these seraphim angels, and they are ruling in their various cult centers several different civilizations in the antediluvian world, which, again, most people from a Christian perspective don't really understand this, but it's clear that the seraphim angels were the archons, they were the celestial mafia, they were the several other different names that people describe these angels as authorities and other names that ruled these centers. And there was also the descendants of Cain and Enoch that were partnering with these fallen angels before the rise of the Nephilim from the fallen angels. And what was going on was is that, and Freemasonry is just absolutely loaded with this information, particularly in their in their writings. And Albert Mackey is one of the more famous writers on this with the legends of Freemasonry. You have all the different legends that go back into Freemasonry. So what's going on is Adam is taught in Eden the seven sacred sciences, and people would know those today as the seven liberal sciences. And so this knowledge is taught to Adam, and then Adam teaches that to Cain and to Abel, but Abel is murdered. And so Adam then teaches this to Seth as the other bloodline, and Cain is banished for the murder of Abel. And so we see the development of this knowledge in two different ways. One that honors the God of the universe as the Bible looks at it, and this other version that gets perverted into a polytheist or multiple God or paganism as Christians might call it. And so they develop this knowledge and this religion at the same time. And this knowledge is so powerful that it could probably destroy the universe if taken to the umpteenth end with the absolute science, which is alchemy, as the secret societies would look at it. But they were developing this knowledge in all different levels, including Masonry, which is the fifth science of geometry, for the listeners that may not know. And so this was put into a religion to honor the fallen angels, and particularly Lucifer. And so they created initiatory societies and religions to protect this information and to develop it. And so we have this incredible technology developing in the antediluvian age, and we have the rise of the secret societies, we have the rise of the mystical religions, and we have the descendants of Cain partnering with the fallen angels. And then in Genesis 6, 200 of these fallen angels go to Mount Hermon, and they create these super beings known as Nephilim, who are giants. And so this is the conspiracy that was rising that eventually caused the flood. It also crossed the flood afterwards and continues to this day. So it's important to understand all of these roots. So I just covered a whole bunch of territory there, Freeman. So if you have some questions that you may want to ask me or want me to backtrack on that, it would probably be a good time to do so.
Okay, well, let's talk about these guys, these beings, these giants, and relate this to how, so people can see just how much influence this has had on our current modern society. So I'll go back to a little bit of the Book of Enoch, and we have the giants devour all the food that men of Earth can produce. Nothing satiates their hunger. They kill and eat birds, beasts, reptiles, and fish. To their gargantuan appetites, nothing is sacrosanct. Soon, even Homo sapiens become a delicacy. Now, when we start to look at what these watchers brought to humanity, you find warfare, you find makeup, you find high heel shoes and jewelry. You got the practices of magic and cannibalism. All of this being brought down, according to the Book of Enoch, by characters such as Azrael, or Azazel, as some pronounce in the certain interpretations, who creates accoutrements for their consorts, makeup, bracelets, to enhance their sex appeal. All of that modern fashion and the ideas that we have of what society is today and civilization has its roots right there in what the giants brought to mankind, right?
Nothing new is under the sun. So what took place in the days of Noah, if you're into end time prophecy and world government as I am, will take place in the end time, just as it did in the times of Noah. And that's why it's so important to understand what happened before the flood. And these Nephilim although in many other accounts, let's say in Greek or in other mythologies around the world, and again, if people do not understand, giants and giants related to the flood catastrophe is in over 500 different cultures around the world. It's on every continent, and they essentially tell the same story. So if you look at a Greek mythology, they have Titans, if you have the Sumerian, and with Sitchin, you have the Anunnaki and the Igigi gods, and they're telling the same story. And so in the beginning, the Nephilim, when they're first created, it seems as though they weren't as evil as they became. But over time, they became either hubris, which is some people believe is a word that is rooted in the Titan rebellion of overreach. But they began to rebel against God in the biblical version and against the gods in the other versions of mythologies and religions around the world. And not only did they eat human beings, they also started this blood-drinking cult that we see today in the vampire myth and has been with us through the whole world. That this is all related. It's too soon to probably get into that aspect about it, but understand that blood-drinking was a typical Nephilim trait. And they did it to recreate longer life, or it was what they hoped for, as I understand it, in one aspect. And the other aspect was it was just a supplement to help their cognizant abilities. But they certainly did drink blood. And if you go to Genesis 6, it said that these fallen angels created these giants, and then God says, my spirit's not going to contend with man forever because he's mortal. I'm going to limit that to 120 years. And so what people need to understand is that the original Nephilim were immortal. And even though their bodies died out, their spirits remain. They're not permitted into heaven. And those are what we call demons today. And I think Enoch does a very good job in laying that whole sort of doctrine out. And again, it works perfectly with what Scripture says. And so the generations after the original Nephilim, although long-lived, were not immortal. And so we need to know that there's a separation between the descendants after the first generation and the descendants in the first generation.
Well, with people like Kissinger still running around, you've really got to wonder if these guys are bathing in blood, right?
Well, the blood drinking cult is still said to be very, very active amongst the higher levels of the secret society. So when you get into sort of the apex of Freemasonry, which would be the Rosicrucians or the Illuminati, then that tends to be more of a cult. But I think that is actually at a higher level than the Illuminati, so probably at the higher levels of the Rosicrucians and higher into the more ennobled bloodlines after that. So,
well, I've always believed that these elite, as they seem to be of our inhuman society, have some sort of DNA coding receptors that just make them more open to these type of demonic possessions, if you will.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly their belief in their belief system is that they have what they call the gene of Isis. And so something in the DNA is distinctly different that they're trying to reunite and will eventually give them the immortality that they want in the end time. There's also a lot of discussion out there, and again, this is all speculative, that there's something to do with the blood, that there's this Rh negative bloodline that the royals have that goes back to the Nephilim, because it seems to be inserted into human history that's unexplained at this point in time. But there's nothing to really prove that, other than the fact that we could connect a couple of dots and say that whether it's the royals of the ancient times or the royals of today or the elite of today, they like to intermarry and keep those bloodlines still pure, and they track those genealogies all the way back into prehistory. So that doesn't mean that there's necessarily an Rh negative factor or something that's recognized in the bloodline, but certainly they want to keep their bloodlines pure going back to the Nephilim and to the gods, because that's their sort of legacy or right of inheritance is how they look at it. And also, if we look at the Rosicrucian doctrine of something in the blood that is kept there for the creation and demands the creation of superhumans, then we have a little bit more going on here. And if we look at the real VRIL aspect of National Socialism and the Thule Society and all of that sort of occultism that goes back to the same things that we're talking about, which can be a complete sort of interview and discussion in itself, they felt that there was something in the blood as well, then that it goes back to their Aryan society of superhumans that were created in the time of fallen angels. So there's a lot of mythos to this blood and something in of the blood and a connection to superheroes that I think people need to understand. And even when we look at superheroes, for example, just to give somebody some people some more context to the strength of this mythos that's been going on for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, is that if you go to the ancient definition of hero, as what they are called in Genesis 6, the heroes of old and the men of renown, and also, which isn't a coincidence in my book, if you go into some of the Greek mythologies and classics like Homer, they're going to talk about the heroes and the men of renown. And so that wording is identical. And I think that's a testimony to something was significant that was going on in that same period of time. And they're talking about the same type of being between Titans and Nephilim. But the ancient definition of hero is born of a god and a human, aka a demigod. And so just by using the ancient application as how people understood hero, then we really have a complete sort of definition of these Nephilim beings as being a super being. And there are other references where we can talk about the size of them and other aspects in the physical traits, which I think people might find surprising, some of those traits. But these were demigods. And that's why when we talk about that immortal spirit that was put in them, and God steps in and limits it to 120 years, he did not want this violation against creation. It was where the spirit of heaven was not to be combined with the flesh of this realm, and that was the violation that they had created. And when we go back again, as using the same parallel analogy, that when these heroes died in Greek mythology, this is where the hero worship comes from, that they believed that their hero, after he died, his spirit would come back to their village, and they would do sacrifices and rituals and gifts and things to try and make sure that this hero wasn't going to be a morbid, vengeful, haunting type of demon that was coming back. And this is also the same belief that the Chinese have in the Tao religion, the ancient Tao, which people know today as more as Taoism. This was ancient Tao, where they have the vagabond ghost spirits that would come back after they died, and these were those heroes, and they used to hang things on their wall and try and protect themselves from the vengefulness of these spirits coming back. So, again, covered a lot of territory in what I've talked about, and again, give you a chance to see whether or not there's a couple areas in there you want to pry open a little deeper, Freeman.
Definitely, and I'm loving this. Absolutely, Gary. This is good. And we're going to go back to the physical traits of the Nephilim, get into Gilgamesh a little bit, but I want to get your opinion on this idea, since we're talking about the gene of Isis. It immediately made me think of the 30-plus stem cell experiments going on the International Space Station, which could also be called the Isis. They are there seeking longevity for humanity. They are using Mark Kelly and his brother, whose name always seems to slip my brain for some reason, but the Kelly brothers, who are twins, they are using them in space experiments seeking longevity. We just now got an announcement that the UK is now performing DNA altering on embryos, and President Barack Obama himself has released all restrictions on federal funding for human cloning. So before we get back to the traits of the Nephilim, I just want to get your opinion on some of the modern weirdness that's going on with these people and their DNA altering.
Well, it's also part of the new man concept that the Nazis had, which is the same Nephilim sort of thing, or transhumanism as the popular term is today. And whether or not you have angels that are going to be released from the abyss or already have been released from the abyss that are going to create Nephilim in the end time, or it's the descendants of the Nephilim, we're going to have a Nephilim type of influence with the end time. And so when we look at what was going on in prehistory, not only do we have the copulation to create these super beings, but we have a whole bunch of other really, really weird things going on in prehistory. And again, I go back to what the Messiah of my religion says, Jesus, that the days will be like the days of Noah. So we need to look at all the aspects that were going on in the times of Noah. And we get these really interesting figures out of prehistory and beings out of prehistory that are sort of unaccounted for and, again, kind of shelved off to just being, well, that's a fabrication or that's an imagination. But, you know, if you go up to somebody from Greece and you say that their ancient mythology is nothing but a fairy tale, which I don't use the word lightly because fairy tales are completely connected into this whole story, they're probably going to be offended because they look at their mythology as their history. Or if you were to go to Native North Americans and say that their mythology is not history, they would be offended as well, and they should be because it's been carried down from generation to generation as their history. Whether or not it has changed a little bit or not, that's a little bit speculative, but I think we have to be careful to not write them off completely to fantasy. And once we do that and we start to see how they line up with each of the other mythologies around the world and each of the religions around the world that are telling the same story, then we have way too many coincidences to dispute. And so where I'm going with this is let's just, out of, for sake of ease and understanding of the type of beings that were created in prehistory with obviously the development of these seven sacred sciences, let's take the centaurs. And that was a crossbreed between humans and horses. Well, we would probably either know that as a crossbreeding of physical sexual nature or DNA manipulation, probably more like DNA manipulation. We have other beings like the Pegasus. This is in Greek mythology again. But we also have a whole bunch of other really strange animals in other religions around the world. And, you know, there is, like, as an example, there's this this god or being in India that has the head of a elephant. And there's another one there that has all of these different arms. They might have like eight arms and a whole bunch of other different figures. And it doesn't matter which religion or which mythology you go to, they talk about other beings. Just as when we look at some of the more modern literature or the classics in history, they're filled with things like Nereids out of Atlantis or fairies or elves or little people. And again, even Native North American mythologies talk about the little people and the giants. And of course, they also have Sasquatch as well. And again, we have this sort of duplication of what was really going on in prehistory and how many other types of beings were going on and how far did that technology develop. Did they actually have the capability to do DNA manipulation? Certainly when we get into the Gnostic religions and certain of the Gnostic Gospels, they'll talk about taking humans and beings into a cloud where they come back with as another being. And so when we look at that, you know, that starts opening up Pandora's box again of a whole bunch of other different questions as to why in a cloud and is that in space or what are they actually getting at there, perhaps with aliens. But where I'm coming from is this is not an unknown doctrine out of prehistory.
Yeah,
and yet we're seeing it today again.
Well, you brought up Sasquatch. Let's go ahead and take this to the Book of Enoch, because when King Enoch is one that the folks can go and look up. King Gilgamesh. All right, let me get that right. Gilgamesh is who I'm talking about here. And King Gilgamesh, a giant, you can read these accounts of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which really kind of was the first hero's tale, But in this very story also is the very first Bigfoot story, as the gods had to create Enkidu, a Bigfoot character, to battle King Gilgamesh to keep him from raping and beating all his own people, right?
Yeah. So I don't look at Enkidu or Enkidu, as the other translations put it, as a Sasquatch. All Nephilim were known to be hairy. So Enkidu would be just another hairy Nephilim. But that doesn't mean that Sasquatch isn't in this mythos of prehistory. And I kind of look at that as more as, and again, I have nothing, this is my own speculation. So, and I'm going to come back to Gilgamesh and Enkidu, because that's an interesting little tangent I want to get on as well. Is that if you go into fairy mythology, which again, I've not made the connection here, but understand this is all connected and it goes back into prehistory as well. Well, maybe I'll just throw that out just so that people understand. There's four classifications of fairies that go back into prehistory. So you have these fallen rebellious angels that rebelled, that came to this planet. And some people look at those as aliens, whereas I tend to look at it as the fallen angels. There's the earthborn fairies, which is the Nephilim that they created. There's the daemons or the demons, which are the bodiless spirits of these earthborn fairies. So again, just as I talked about with Nephilim in the original generation. And then there's the elementals, which is the fourth classification of fairies. And they're split into three, which are gnomes and goblins, which are ugly. And then you've got the leprechauns, and then you've got the little people. And the good-looking fairies will be in those other two categories. So understand that fairies are all interrelated into this whole sort of Genesis 6 conspiracy that I talk about at length in my book. But the ogres that come out of the fairy tales, these are, some people believe that these are some of the inhabitants of Britain before the Celts got there and the Scythians got there. And so when we look at some of the depictions of ogres, like in Jack and the Beanstalk, which again, incidentally, is a fairy tale, or in Jack the Giant Killer or Puss in Boots, or this is a depiction of a deformed type of Nephilim. And just as in the Tuatha De Danann mythology, which again, they are the fairy people here, so there's another connection. And there's about six or seven different allegories that go along with the fairy mythos. So if I'm losing some people, I just want to throw that out. But there's a race that the Tuatha De Danann defeat and kind of absorb, and they're a race of giants that are hairy and deformed, and they're called the Firbolg. And you've got this sort of ogre thing that comes up in Japanese history and all around the world. And so I'm thinking more that the ogre is more of a representation of the Sasquatch, and it's intermixed into this fairy mythology as another separate being from prehistory, just my conclusion. And then when I see things like in Star Wars, which, of course, everybody knows the Star Wars movie was just re-released with the new preset of movies, and seeing the first one, and we have this very interesting character that's in there that's kind of kept alive that kind of reminds me of a Sasquatch, and that's Chewbacca. And again, what happens in all of this entertainment in history is we see genealogies, we see beings, and we see history being encoded into these stories. So I don't look at Chewbacca as part of Star Wars as being a fluke or a coincidence. I think it's there with a message and for a reason. So, but the difference is I just think that Sasquatch and Nephilim are just they may be coming from the same period of time, but I think they're a different being. And so when we go back now to Enkidu, which was hairy, and Gilgamesh, let's just talk a little bit about this story. And this is the oldest record that secular history likes to use of the mythology of the flood. And it predates the Christian story. And they like to use this one as, well, the writers of the Bible just copied the Epic of Gilgamesh version and maybe changed it a little bit. And that, you know, that sounds good. They're pretty similar. And the stories are very, very similar at the macro level. But when you get into the details, and to me, the devil is in the details when you get into this, this is talking about two different stories, two different accounts of the same catastrophe. I am looking at this that when I look at Gilgamesh, and Gilgamesh is also recorded as a giant in the books of Enoch from before the flood, as being warned by Enoch about the flood was going to come, that all of a sudden now we have Gilgamesh in a Sumerian epic as a being that survived the flood. That's not coincidence, in my opinion, my conclusion. And Gilgamesh was an archetypical, a model Nephilim. He was brutal. He was a king. He was evil. He took any women he chose. These are all Nephilim traits. And so Enkidu is created after the flood to control Gilgamesh. And he's created in the same way all Nephilim are created. And he is also a demigod, just as Gilgamesh was a demigod. And he's a giant, just as Gilgamesh was a giant, but they'd soon become good friends, as opposed to keeping Gilgamesh at bay. And he's relaying the story of the flood to Enkidu. And Zayazudra, or Upnapishtim, depending on which translation that you're utilizing for the flood, is the king of the flood.
And he is... most people relate to Noah, right?
And that's who most people relate to Noah. But again, he is a giant. He is a demigod. He is the model warlike warlord king, whereas Noah is this simple human, agrarian, vegetarian human being. Totally opposite. And that the lives that they live are completely different. Different beings, different objectives, different results. And so we have three Nephilim in the Epic of Gilgamesh story, and we're also told that they took many other family members with them on the ark. And so this is, in my opinion, a story about the flood and about the giants, the Epic of Gilgamesh, but the giant Nephilim Anunnaki survival story. Just like if we go to Greek mythology, and they also have a flood story, and it's the Koulian and Noria, and she has many different versions, including Nama, a descendant of Lamech, daughter of Lamech, of the lineage of Cain. Deucalion is what people like to say, in particular in secular history, saying that is the Greek Noah story. Well, Deucalion is the son of Prometheus. And again, whether or not Prometheus is a Nephilim or a god, because again, there are two levels of Titans. One were gods and one were earthborn gods. So there's two different levels. So whether he's a fallen angel, a lower level god, or a Nephilim makes no difference. Deucalion is a Nephilim. And so this, again, is a story of the survival of the Titans in one aspect of how they survived, although Greek mythology will also cite other ways they survived the flood. So I think we have completely different stories, although very, very similar at the macro level.
I see. That is very intriguing. I totally get what you're saying there. So you're getting both sides of the puzzle, really. Because, you know, as the Bible states, the Nephilim existed then and afterwards.
Yeah, which again is, you know, sends Christians bonkers, because generally they'll look at it and say, but only Noah, his wife, his three sons, and their three wives survived the flood. Well, how is that possible then?
Yeah, yeah.
Then, and they say, well, that's not quite what it means. And you could say, okay, there was two different violations. One was before the flood, and then they recreated giants after the flood, and the Gnostics have some stories on that. And certainly, we just talked about Enkidu was created after the flood in the same way, so that's a possibility. But it's not just not as simple as that, because we also have so many other people that are talked about in the Old Testament that don't go back to the Table of Nations. And for people who may not be aware of what the Table of Nations are, that's in Genesis and First Chronicles, where it lists all of the descendants of Noah and their sons. And so we have these peoples that are coming in from nowhere. They do not go back to the Table of Nations. And those would be people like the Raphaites, like King Og was a Raphaite. And we have the Avites, and we have the Ozim, and we have the Emites, and we have the Zamzamites. And on and on and on, we have the Anakites. And there's so many different names. And then these are all descendants of giants. So again,
these are beings that the reporters said that they felt like grasshoppers next to.
Absolutely. And so how did they survive the flood? And then you get a very interesting account of King Og, who was either 13 feet or had a bed that was either 13 to 14 feet or 16 feet, depending on which dimension that you're going to use, because there was a royal cubit and a common cubit. And I make the case that the Nephilim and the giants were all the kings and started the royal dynasties in the book that are still around today with their descendants and the royal families, that if they were royal, they would have used a royal cubit. So they would have been, you know, every cubit would have been bigger than a common cubit. So that would make Goliath, as one of the Nephilim later on in the book, not 8 feet tall, but, you know, closer to 11 feet tall. And so you could have Og, in this case, as being either 13 feet tall or 16 feet tall. And, of course, his bed that went along with it, which was made of iron because he was so big and heavy, that wood wouldn't support it, would have been bigger as well than what most people would understand that. But here's what's interesting about King Og. He is known as the last survivor or the last remnant or the last of the Rephaites when he fights with Joshua, just before Joshua and the Israelites crossed the Jordan. Well, that's a very, very strange comment. And that comes out of both Joshua and Deuteronomy, Joshua 12:4 and Deuteronomy 3:11, if people would like to check that out. And the reason why that's very odd is that Rephaites survive after that. They're still in the land of Israel, and we learn that Anakites are Raphaites, and we have all these other people that go back to being linked as Raphaites and Anakites. And as I just noted, and I'll connect in my book, that Goliath was a Raphaite, and I'll connect him back. So Raphaites survived after Og, and Sihon, who was his brother, went to fight Joshua just before and was slaughtered in battle, as was with his sons, and as Og's sons were slaughtered. So Og is the last of the Raphaites, or the remnant of it, which is so odd, unless he somehow survived the flood. And I'll also name other people that survived the flood, like the Amalekites, as a nation that comes out of nowhere and disappears into nowhere, and I'll talk about that story in the flood as well. And I will connect them to probably being the Horites in the Table of Nations. And these Horites, the descendants of Seir, and Seir himself, who is inserted into the Table of Nations, he comes out of nowhere and is unaccounted for. And then we have other peoples like the Gerzites and the Gezerites and the Machites that lived amongst the Amalekites, that who biblical historians and researchers will say, well, this is the same mystery as the Anakite and the Rephaites and the Amalekites. They don't know where they came from. And then from human people, we have a couple other races known as the Kenites, the Kenites, and the Kenizzites as a couple of examples. And they actually trace their heritage back to Tubal-Cain and to Cain from before the flood. So how can that be? And again, they do not come out of the Table of Nations. And so I'll also make the case just for one other thing in case people are not sure, well, what I'm getting at in terms of how do I know that that these people aren't in the Table of Nations? Well, they don't connect back to anybody. And I'll tell you this, anybody that's listed in the Table of Nations, including Nimrod, in my conclusion, although he may have married into the Nephilim bloodline and was a Nephilim wannabe and was a larger human than normal and was a great hunter and everything, he is in the Table of Nations. If you're in the Table of Nations, you have a descendancy back to Noah. If you're not in there, you do not.
Now, this Table of Nations, that's in the Bible, or what is that?
That is, as I explained earlier, in Genesis and in First Chronicles, and it's easiest to go right to First Chronicles, first chapter, and it lists all of the descendants of Noah and the sons of Noah.
Right.
That's survived the flood.
Okay.
Okay. And so Nimrod doesn't have any descendants that are shown afterwards. Or the Canaanites, like the Hittites and the Amorites, they don't show any descendants afterwards because they became interbred with giants. And again, I'll make the case in the book that they likely interbred with the original Nephilim. Now, if I want to get back to the integrity of Genesis and start explaining some of this, which also takes up a portion of my book, is that if you look in the flood story, it does say that God destroyed everything that wasn't on the ark in terms of humans and animals and things like that, but it says all the things he created. As opposed to the case of the Nephilim, where they were created by rogue dark angels and not God, because they copulated with human females and created a new breed of being.
What do you think about the Smithsonian hiding these artifacts and these skeletons of giants?
Well, that's an incredible story in itself. You know, I've done some research, and I look back on old newspaper articles, and I've got some of those posted on my website with some links. And there's a long history of the discovery of giants in the United States and a little bit in Canada. There's pictures in some of these newspapers, and there's stories, and there's firsthand accounts, and it's all there to be written or for to be read. And all of this goes. These discoveries, they go to the Smithsonian Institute, and these are discoveries that, say, start about 1850 or so early, maybe a little sooner than that, and go right up to about the 1930s and 40s, and maybe a little bit longer, but that's the mainstay of them. And they all go to the Smithsonian, and they mysteriously disappear, and there's no record of that. Well, we do have a record, it's just that it's just newspaper articles and accounts of people that are talking about it from generations from before. So I think it's a deliberate, my speculation is it's a deliberate gambit on their part to keep this whole notion on the shelves and hidden behind a vault of secrecy until they're ready to present it to the world, which will be in the end time. And so if somebody is wondering, well, okay, why would the Smithsonian do that? I'll talk about that in the book, and it happens further on. So when we get into the secret societies, you need to understand that the Royal Society, which started education away from the church in a gambit to move education and take control of education, was created by Rosicrucians, Freemasonry, and was sort of a point in history where they moved from magic to science, from sorcerers to scientists, and created sort of this working space between themselves and the Roman Church that it wasn't the sorcery stuff, that they're going to just do it in a scientific basis. But their true objective was to continue to develop the seven sacred sciences and take it to the levels that it was in prehistory and to create monuments to honor their God, which is the great architect of the universe, which is Lucifer, and to brainwash people away from monotheism and to eventually destroy Christianity as we know it for the end time and in preparation for the end time, and is all part of the sort of this web of organizations that I get into in the book.
Fantastic. And yes, the Royal Society just had a huge meeting on what to do when we meet extraterrestrials. They also included members that were working on mind transfer technologies and DNA altering, all in the same meeting at the Royal Society. You had your extraterrestrial ambassadors gathering together. You had Henry Markram of the Blue Brain Project, Paul Davies of Are We Alone? And this is the Royal Society bringing this new world to us. And so as we wrap up this first hour, Gary, tell us what's going to happen as we are seemingly this terminal generation. And then, any thoughts you want to give to the listening audience? And then also just tell us what you're going to be doing in the very near future.
Well, what's going to happen is that these groups that are working, there's basically two different belief systems in the world. And yes, there's one that's agnostic, but an atheist. But the two main ones are monotheism and polytheism. And both of them talk about the same things in prehistory, and both of them talk about the same things in the end time. And that the people of this other belief system of polytheism and the secret societies and of fallen angels, they want to bring on the end time. They are working actively to do this. They want this rendezvous with destiny. They believe that they can win this rendezvous with destiny. They'll accept the ordained times, but they would prefer to do it beforehand. So they are going to be continuing to move towards world government, world trades, dividing the world up into 10 economic zones, empires, spheres of influence, things like you might look at NAFTA or the EEC as a similar model for that. And as they try and bring on the spirit, the inspirational spirit of the founding of the Royal Society's dream, Sir Francis Bacon, the New Atlantis. And of course, this brings back memories of prehistory that there were 10 empires in the Atlantean Empire that was known in Greek mythology as the helm of world government, even though they didn't exactly take over the whole world, they were trying back then. And so this is, again, a theme that's for the Antichrist in the end time with world government and taking over the whole world. So they're trying to bring about this new Atlantis, just as the Club of Rome that was created, which is a very, very high organization in these secret societies, was created in the late 60s and perhaps early 70s, but I'm thinking more late 60s as I think about it more. Their main objective is to bring world government divided into 10 zones that they have already pre-designed. And so all of this is coming together. So that's what they're doing today, and they want this rendezvous with destiny.
Oh, I have to add, without a doubt, Barack Obama has already named the 10 regional governors of America, folks. That was years ago, okay? So if you're not caught up. And the Club of Rome absolutely brought the very concepts of project of Agenda 21, the concepts of limits to growth, coming straight to you from the Club of Rome and going straight into your scholasticism so that all the children can feel guilty about living on planet Earth. Without a doubt, Gary, you are hitting this right on the head. It's such an important topic because it's the one when everybody's asking, well, who are the Illuminati? I think you have the answer.
I certainly have my point of view on it.
There you go. Folks, his website is Genesis6Conspiracy.com. And you definitely want to get over there. Of course, you can purchase his books right here on FreemanTV.com. And his name is Gary Wayne, just so you get that straight. And I get it straight. Sorry about that. Do you have lectures coming up? Do you have anything coming in the near future? Do you have books that you're working on?
Yeah, I don't have a lecture tour coming up, but I'm doing a lot of media and a lot of promoting. I don't have the platform that most people have. So I come by this as somebody that's absolutely new to the genre and starting to get a lot of attention on it, because I think what I do is I bring more information and more footnotes. I have over 100 pages of endnotes, so everybody can look to where I'm sourcing my information from. and they'll know what I'm speculating on and what I'm not speculating on. And so I've got over 100 pages of endnotes in there. And so it's, I think it's the most researched book that's out there by an extraordinary level. And it's got 98 chapters plus a preface and an epilogue. And it comes at you with every chapter with information, and it keeps coming at you right through to the end. And because it's an 800-page book with so much information, I wrote it in 98 chapters, which are mini stories, which kind of sort of lead into each other and keep coming up as the book unfolds, so that you can read a chapter, come back, read another chapter, come back, because it's going to take a while to get through this book. And the other objective I was trying to do with the book was I wanted to create one narrative, one complete narrative, right from the beginning and right to the end, that nobody has written about, and how all of these things rose at the same time. They've been active all throughout our history, have manipulated our history, and will manipulate our future.
Without a doubt, folks, you want to get this Genesis 6 conspiracy. And I want to thank you all for tuning in and catching up on this and realize how important this information is. So I hope you're enjoying the new freemantv.com. Please share it with your friends. I'm only going to make it better from here on out. Things are going to get bigger, better, and bolder. I promise you that. Get over to Genesis6conspiracy.com. And check out all the works of Gary Wayne. And, well, members, stay tuned, because we're going to take Lucifer to vampires and aliens. We're going to dig into the legends of the craft, and we're going to get deep into the mystery of imagination. So stay tuned, members, and the rest of you, thank you so much for tuning in here every week and keeping us going. And please give your thumbs up on whatever platform you happen to be listening to, Stitcher, iTunes, wherever this is going, YouTube. And, you know, don't forget to kick in a buck or two here just to help things go along. You don't have to become a member, but I highly recommend it. It's a mere $7 a month, or you can just pay $75 for the year, and you're good to go, and you're going to get everything, and you're going to supply me with the needs I need to get out to the world, because this is the information people need to make the proper choices and where our society is going to go. Because as Gary Wayne is saying, it really appears that we are the terminal generation at the end of this story, and we have to make a difference. And so it's up to you and me, folks. So let's get out there and do it. So I will see you all next week. And members, stay tuned. We're coming right back.